the development of the, what would you call it, a machine or a tool or whatever?
Well, it was a machine that makes the corn kernels.
Corn kernels, yeah. And where did that happen? Did that happen on your farm, was it not?
The machine was, it started on our farm because we had a herdsman. Working with my father, thought there was a better way to produce feed for cattle than putting the grain through a burr mill. So he rigged up a little affair that would feed the grain mill, in this case through a wagon hub, and the axle of the wagon was twirling in that hub, and then he had to put the grooves that would carry the feed down. So first thing you know, he knew, both from a surprise, it didn't come out as a flat cake, flat flake, but it came out scorched and tasted good. And so they tried everything on it, and they had people down from Hortonberryman, I guess, and they had Wisconsin agriculturalists, and various people came in to look at this.
It was a curl, too.
All right. And
well, what did you put in it? Did you put in corn or oats or most anything?
They tried everything.
Corn or
oats or
barley?
Barley, anyway. Uh-huh. And then my father relinquished any claim on the idea. I don't know when patents were taken out on it, but this Per Matthews needed a machine shop to work in, so he took in a man named Shrupke aboard to have a little machine shop and gave him half interest in the idea for working with him. And they came time when they didn't feel that they knew enough about engineering or about salesmanship to go alone, so each of them gave a half of his share. One of them gave it to Harry Adams, and the other one gave it to a man named Barry from the ironworks. Of course, Barry was the engineer, and Adams was the lawyer. Well, then many years after, the idea hadn't produced more than enough to pay the offices. And every year or two, we got 2 or 3% for furnishing a living for Matthews when he moved off the floor. So we had an interest in the business. And every couple of years, there'd be a business meeting, and the people that had bought into the firm, and many had, would call on us. We had 3%. They wanted to get enough to control the company.
51%. Someone wanted to get 51%?
Yeah, that's right. And it was awfully interesting, these meetings, because the officers were thrown out, and a new batch of officers came in, and there was nothing, nothing for the shareholders, because all of the income would be gone to the officers. And this was Flake Hall Corporation.
Well, didn't they? There was a machine in the Krause's feed mill on Sherland Avenue. Is that true or no?
Yeah, probably.
That's what I remember.
Krause. They had a little shop on the river just south of Sherland Avenue.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, I remember people calling on me from Ohio or Iowa or this and that and the other. Were awfully interested in getting my vote. And, I didn't do anything. I just sat there. But eventually, things shifted around until the Adams got 51%. Uh-huh. And from then on, the company took off. Uh-huh. And they had another company formed to process this material made out of cornmeal. Uh-huh. And it was named, what is it?
Today, now? Yeah. Corn Curls?
Corn Curls.
Corn Curls, yeah. Adams Corn Curls.
Yeah.
That's the way it came out of the first place where they took the cornmeal, that's the way it came out, Corn Curl.
Oh.
So they called it, right on the building sign, they called it Corn Curl.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, Adams has got an awful lot of credit coming to them for being able to take a company that had just paddled along for 15 years or more.
It was that long?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And not really being able to put it together.
Uh-huh.
And now the current Corn Curl company has been bought by the Atlas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And everybody's been paid off at 100 cents on the dollar. Remember, I got about $12,000 out of it.
Is that right? Well, it amounted to that much.
What? Oh, yeah.
Oh, I never realized that.
We've been on the board for a long time.
That's you were on the...
little shares, whatever it was.
Oh.
But I remember the night he came home and said that they paid everybody else off, him included, so they didn't keep it on the board anymore.
Huh. Well, they sold to Beatrice.
When did they sell to Beatrice?
Oh, I don't know. It's a long time. It's a
all
long time.
All the men in the paper that he wrote. Yeah. They had it, right?
Let's see. Well, you were on the board. When did there start being a board? When Mr. Matthews joined the machine company?
Well, as I said, first was Matthews, and then there was Matthews and Swepke, Matthews, Swepke, Marion Adams.
At that time, there was a board of directors.
Who just owned the company. They just owned the company.
Yeah.
And then they were selling off shares in the company. Now, I don't know whether it was incorporated then or not.
But they were selling shares to raise money, obviously.
Yeah. And for instance, our friend Matthews, Terry Matthews, he lived on the proceeds from that business up until he died.
Oh.
And he only died last year down in Florida.
Oh.
And so it's been good to him. But,
well, it was pretty near as good as being a herdsman for your dad.
Yeah. Pretty good.
I think Adams paid him something over there. Oh. I didn't make him money.
Now we are.
All right. Not a problem. As far as we're concerned, my father started because I was interested in raising seed corn for sale. And I was running the milk bins pretty much, and that was my main interest. And the first thing I knew, he had a half an acre of seed corn planted, produced seed. And he'd got his seed from the University of Wisconsin. And for a long time, the United States Department of Agriculture felt that the university crossing stocks that had in our name, A time B crossed on C time D, and called, say, 464. That name of 464 should go on to any corn that was produced of that pedigree. And, well, after the first year, when I found out that this corn would sell for $7 a bushel, I thought, well, that's the thing for me, because I was interested in merchandising corn.
Yeah.
So,
okay, now let's say who you are. Who are you?
Oh, Ron Dogan.
Ron Dogan, and on the Dogan farm right just east of Beloit.
And we sold Dogan hybrids for 30 years, I suppose.
Yes.
Under our own name, but I said sold a little previously of this business of the same pedigree had to be sold under the same name, no matter who produced it. Under the supervision and the guarantee of the University of Wisconsin, for instance, in Wisconsin. Well, that means that anybody that wanted to grow a little seed for sale could buy this stock, and then I have to sell it under the same name. But I would have to grow the corn, and if I wanted to grow 100 acres of seed and go to the expense of promoting it, advertise it, I'd have to advertise it as under the, what would you call it, generic term?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe that would be it.
That's pretty good.
And so a neighbor of mine or somebody in the next township could grow a little corn, but he had to pay for his tractor, we'll say, and he needed the money pretty badly, so he would undercut me for $2 or $3.
Oh. Now, what year was
this? So it didn't pay me to advertise at all.
Oh.
Or put any money into advertising.
I see. But what year? What years were
they? Oh, I don't know. 38. Maybe it was 38.
Huh.
I could find that out for you, I suppose. But anyway, we started small and we never did get big. But I suppose we were settling about 4,000 bushels of seed corn at the, and we were doing our best.
A lot of people working for you, sorry.
Yeah, we had about 60. Listen, you're giving him a bad time, bro. Trying to get your own voice in there, too.
Well, that's okay.
Well, anyway, we had about 60 salesmen all the way from Middleton, northern Wisconsin, way northern Wisconsin, to out of the Dakotas, a few salesmen. And
is that right?
I don't know. But I was the president of the Wisconsin Experiment Association. I don't think I'll look.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good.
For a couple of years, and followed Walter, Wilbur Reck followed me.
Oh, I see.
And they were in the corn business. We were both of us were quite worried about this business of not having a trade name for the corn that we were ourselves producing.
Oh.
Even if it was a widely planted corn at all sorts of prices.
Well, what do you mean you're disturbed about not having a trade name? Is it, it was Dogan, wasn't it?
It was Dogan, but it was Dogan's, we'll say,
Dogan.
XYZ.
Yeah, but it was all came from Wisconsin seed stock.
That's right. And that same seed stock was issued to maybe 100 seed growers in Wisconsin.
Oh, uh-huh.
And
how many others were there in the Beloit area?
Oh, I don't know, a couple, three, Tracy, and out of Janesville, and...
Yeah, but Tracy was not in the seed corn business in 1938, I don't believe.
A little later.
A little later, yeah, because I bought seed from him and about 39 sheet corn or soybean seed, and they, I don't believe they were in it yet at that time.
Well, they started pretty early because Bob Tracy was at University of Wisconsin in the Depression. So he was on the ground floor of what Wisconsin was doing.
Yeah, but they came from Iowa. The Tracys came from Iowa.
Well, I don't know, you know more than I do. I knew they had a little farm out west of Madison.
West of Madison.
West,
okay.
I think.
Yeah.
And they were hauling their milk into Bowman's, not the big Bowman, but
yeah,
the Madison Bowman. And I think they came down here with very little money and bought the land on a shoestring. Bob was a plunger, more so than his father. And he always come up smelling like a rose. And good for him.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that we're facing the business of competing with farmers that had no expense of selling, and advertise their product. They could just hang on somebody's coattail. They could say, well, I've got the same thing that Rick has, and you can get it from me for $2 or $3 or $4 cheaper.
Uh-huh. Sure.
So when I was president of the Wisconsin Farmer Association, I had a meeting in Madison and all the, what's the hotel, it doesn't matter. Anyway, a two-day meeting, and all of the seed producers in the state were invited to come, and most of them did, and the University of Wisconsin was represented, what's O'Neill's first name?
Norman
Neal was the Australian that came to the University of Wisconsin to New Zealand, I think, from New Zealand to study forage crops.
Uh-huh.
And he got in here on the ground floor of seed corn development.
I see.
And so I've known Norman all my life, all my business life. Still in touch with him once in a while. But he, of course, supported the idea that it was really against the law and unethical to put any special name on a generally produced corn.
Is that right?
And he attended this meeting.
Uh-huh.
And this meeting was attended by big growers and small growers.
Uh-huh.
And there were a good deal more small growers than big growers.
Uh-huh.
And the small growers all voted almost as a block
to change, yeah. Make a change.
No, to make it change his genetic name.
Oh,
6XYZ all over the state. Oh. Anybody that produced it.
Oh, really?
And the big dryers wanted to call it. I called mine one of them Doc D, for instance.
I see. Were you a big grower or a little grower?
Well, I was...
Where did you stand?
I was sort of way in between.
Oh.
I would never be called a big grower. We were producing about 4,000 bushels, selling about 4,000 bushels.
Well, I used to help detassel it.
Sure.
Yeah. A lot of the young folks around here did.
So we had the seed processing building designed by Andy Wright, who was at the University of Wisconsin. And then we had a dryer building designed by him. And that was hot air drying. And we were in early on that development. And of course, these buildings are still being used by tenant of mine. I've got nothing to do with it except quite rent for them. But I miss the business. Like I miss the cows. I dream about the cows. I dream about delivering milk in town, and I knew all of the routes. And if the man was sick, or he was off because of death.
Sure.
For any reason. For instance, I had a man named Walter Abbott that was a Sunday Adventist there, and he wouldn't work on Saturday, no matter what happened. Well, if I had a man sick, I would have to go on that route on Saturday. I would have two routes I'd have to run. But anyway, that's under the bridge.
You were the relief man.
Well, I had a relief man, but very often the possibility that
you had to
somebody
relieve.
Was sick and I had to
relieve the relief man.
Well, I think it's important to say that the University of Illinois, for instance, let their village have their back name.
Well, I think...
And Iowa.
I think the bigger ones in Wisconsin and all over, they just went ahead and used any name they wanted on.
Sure, they had pride and they had... But
you started this way. So, Vera, who's been interviewed?
I thought you might leave that out, but it was
well,
very important.
No,
the other universities allowed
their growers to... I think Vera is more than the something that they couldn't control.
Yeah.
So they overlooked it. Now, I think that was true of Tracy, and probably true of Rank, and true of Blaney. And I held out for a long time. I was working with this Professor Neal, Norman Neal. He had trial yields on our place.
I see.
And he was always very close with what was in that trial plot.
Uh-huh.
I'd be looking over his shoulder and he'd always have his thumb over the pedigree. But the result of that meeting was that the small growers that wanted the advertising that the university would give their grants to take precedence, is that the word, over the bigger dealers that wanted to have their own brands and so forth. Now, along then in the early days, Reader started up with a competition with universities.
Okay.
Two of them in Iowa, and I suppose there was three or four of them throughout the United States. I only know of these two in Iowa. And their advanced men would come and visit the farm and say, I think such and such pedigree would be quite useful. And they would sell that pedigree to me, and I would sell it as Doc D, we'll say. And they'll sell it to Blaney, and he would sell it as Blaney Supreme. And they are very, very active competitively with the university.
Well, you mean these large breeders you refer to, like I'm familiar with Pioneer and DeKalb. Would it likely be someone like that, or them specifically, that would be selling this to someone?
Well, they're producing the corn that farmers grow.
Yeah.
But for their own production
uh-huh.
of any cross,
yeah.
They also have their breeding program.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the DeKalb will sell their breeding stock for farmers to use to produce seed themselves to sell.
Uh-huh. Well, now there's Dairyland Research right up here toward Clinton.
Yeah.
And they certainly are developing new seeds with the paper bags over the,
yeah, sure,
the tassels,
yeah,
and the ears, yeah, and so forth. So they're researching for new combinations, I believe. Is that right?
Sure, or they are. Sure, yeah, they are. And the university has, their business has shrunk tremendously.
Oh, in favor of these private breeders.
Yeah. And so we were a little late in marketing our own brands, even if we were using Wisconsin seeds, crossing stocks.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, I started buying my crossing stock from these Iowa concerns. We're in competition with the university. But there was a lot of fun to see our business.
Well, what did it do to the, in your opinion, what did it do to the production, overall production of corn in the, like in the state? For instance, am I right in my assumption and recollections that the average yield in the state of Wisconsin was around 30 bushels to the acre when I started in the early 40s,
probably.
And today the average strikes often over 100 bushels.
Is it that high? I haven't seen it lately.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I told Vera and others that two things that I have done all of my life and have much interest in as any is the production of slate seed corn and the production of milk.
Uh-huh.
And the glut of seed corn, of the glut of corn.
Okay.
And the glut of milk.
Uh-huh.
Is,
You're guilty?
I'm guilty. Because Norman Neal, as much as anybody in the state, was promoting better seed. And Phil Higley and Rock Prentice have gotten the average milk production way, way up, probably twice as much as it used to be.
Yeah, certainly is. However, there were times through the years of my life that there was concern that down the road, X number of years, there wouldn't be enough food to go around, and that was based on the rate of production at that particular point in time. And now, these developments have come about, and what would have happened if you hadn't done your work, and if Rockefeller Prentice hadn't done his work and so forth?
Yeah, you'd have shortages, and farmers' prices would be higher.
It might have been some famines, too.
Yeah.
So.
I don't think that this overproduction is going to last forever. I know not until they can control, until we can control the breeding habits of humanity.
For the truly needy. On the other, so if the cuts for this year go through, it'll be a different matter. But so far, it's simply been that, I guess I got to throw another chart of Wisconsin's in the little bit of the public. There's some people talk about the notch or the poverty trap. And this always exists to some extent. In other words, if you're getting a certain amount of welfare, and you get a job, and the punishment, and then for every dollar that you earn, you lose a dollar of welfare. That is a discouragement to work. So in response, and this is usually what's regarded as the notch. In order to get around that to some extent, what you try to do is to phase it out. As for example, in Social Security, which is really not a poverty program, but once you exceed the limit of $6,000, then you lose, for every $2 you earn, you lose $1 of Social Security. And the idea is there's still an incentive to work there. One of the problems with that, of course, is that it increases the expense to do it. Whether it's been unemployment for 20 or 30 years or more, I mean, because these people, but there hadn't been programs that people brought them into other things, enjoying the other things. Of course, those people, in a sense, are being stupid. They're living fairly well because their unemployment benefits don't come out over there. But on the other hand, they have not responded themselves. There hasn't been really any great deal of effort. Try to find other ways to move in the direction instead of always talking about. We're here in a difficult area to talk about whether the economy doesn't need workers, and I'm not sure that's true. But if it is true, we certainly then have to find substitutes for factory work that would be equally or more worthwhile than people doing rather than simply chopping the storehouse. The blacks were very concerned about this since the 60s. So this is one of the places where they came up with the idea side. In a sense, the country had decided they didn't need any skilled black workers, they didn't need skilled black workers, skilled white workers. And in a sense, it was something that the union wanted and needed. And even some of them developed the ideas of the possible human side. Human side of things is a
problem. One of the things that seems to be interesting is the attitude toward work, the definition of work that Walt expressed in the picture, in China today, where official unemployment is very low, but one of the reasons for that is that the large numbers of people are put to work doing types of service rather than generating goods, but types of service that ordinarily in this country we consider to be beneath us to do. But there is an ideology present in China, at least to some extent, that gives a sense of worth to that kind of work. It's not viewed as inferior, it's viewed as contributing to the well-being of society. And it may be that in our country, we're going to have to make some shift in our definition of work to more fully embody work that is more oriented toward service than production of goods.
Well, of course, we are moving in that direction, but the trouble is that a lot of the service work is extremely low-paid work. And again, if you're going to relate it to income, as we still do, then you can have difficulty.
Instead of workers of the world unite, perhaps we should say worthy of the world unite, and this could be something the church could promulgate and try to get people more elevated in the sense of self confidence and pride.
Yes.
I do think it's particularly cruel that we do have this low number of unemployed people who have work that in their psyche. And because they can't find work, they're struggling.
Well, I think over a period of time it's about that. Yes. I think it's interesting. Most current unemployed, I mean, most of those who have been unemployed in the last year or so, still aren't allowed to find jobs. You know, 250,000 people turned up in 200 jobs a year in Milwaukee and so on. But if that unemployment finally continued for a long period of time, numbers of people who would adjust to it, but not in a constructive sense, but in just sort of a passive way. I have mixed feelings on this. I'm convinced, of course, that, and in this I'm certainly not a Marxist, I'm convinced that the only way to change can come about is that the working class and middle classes cooperate. Otherwise, we can teach an institute like this. Whereas the Marxist thinks that only through some kind of revolution, particularly the working class, and then when somebody might be up on the working class like the students, which is sort of a fair read. But I don't believe that. In other words, somehow or other we've got to divide, and this is what I felt that Walt says is sort of important. Maybe we need some new way of conceptualizing it. But in another way, though, I do feel that at least for the foreseeable future, we still ought to talk about employment because of these people that you're talking about. And, you know, right now, this whole business of public works, you know, there's been a recent line of letters that have come out from people who work in the depression. People who would much rather work, even in the public service, because of course other people call me great people, so nobody's looking for rise raise, but you know, they work in all small towns, the people were grateful for public works jobs. And in the immediate future, this seems to be the approach to the
yes. One other thing I noticed when we went to Mexico, that everybody in every corner is attempting to be a small business man. Mm-hmm. And yet, you don't see that here, except in the big cities. Sometimes you see the carts, the push carts, the labor. You don't see it in small cities. And you look into it, and there's all sorts of regulations. Mm-hmm.
You mean in this one?
In this city. Yeah. And millions of regulations, you know, to keep vendors off the streets, you know, for various reasons. You know, and I kind of say, why they're encouraging small entrepreneurship at this time. Even if it isn't being taxed, you know, properly, you know, skinny.
Well, actually, there are some people who think that there are numbers of small businesses that are being started today by people who are, or not necessarily.
I'm talking about the vendor type of thing.
But again, you're talking about a massive poor population in Mexico. Not all of them, despite what you said, not all of them are on the streets.
Was there a casino? Maybe
Mark would have had a tough time of it based on just one super.
But I don't see it in the U.S., and yet, they're attempting to do something, apparently, because of course, during the Depression in this country, people used to sell apples and pencils.
Anything else we really worry about? Yes.
Next week's assignment is the next two chapters. It's rather long, but next week breaks up next.
Mm-hmm. You're going to explore what's the
story? Yes, three and four.
But I mean for the next 2 weeks, what they're doing.
Three, four, and five.
Three, four, and five.
But for next week, three and four.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you all.
This is the end of the second class session on February 6th. The next class will be led by Margaret Froese on February 13th.